Have you ever started a new project and then introduced it to the world? It's not just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When Troy and I launched this podcast, we had no idea what we were doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys our products? And believe me, all that bad stuff happened. But I'm happy that we took that leap of faith. We had a lot of tools to help us along the way, and one of the best decisions we made was to have a partner like Shopify on our side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if you get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And you can trust me, my job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might be confused or break technology or interact with products. And I really, truly love Shopify's products. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. That's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
I don't usually offer a warning before an episode. I figure that you know what you're in for whenever you're listening to anything I do. But this one is a little more graphic than other episodes in this series so far have been. So I thought I would put that out there. And then that way, you can't say I didn't warn you. 19th century America was awash with diabolical imagery. It was everywhere. It was used to link the devil to everything from immigrants to abortion, the Catholic Church, Native Americans, and even outspoken women. So it can't be a surprise to learn it was also used to describe some of the most bloodthirsty killers of the day. For anyone who might think that deviant sex murderers and serial killers are monsters of modern times, then let me introduce you to Joseph LePage, one of the most depraved killers you've likely never heard of. LePage was a sexual psychopath and fit the modern definition of the classic lust killer, attacking with the ferocity of a wild animal and unspeakably mutilating the corpse. But his contemporaries described him in less clinical terms. They called him, quote, a fiend incarnate, and more commonly, a, quote, demon of the bottomless pit. For the people of rural New Hampshire, it was nearly impossible to believe that a human being could be capable of the things that LePage did. Such acts, they insisted, could only be carried out by a servant of the devil, a monster that could have only have come from hell. And who knows? Maybe they were right. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. As you're aware from previous episodes, our journey back in time is currently exploring the diabolical figure of the devil, the source of so many of America's fears. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 11, The Demon from the Bottomless Pit. The killer who would come to be regarded in such demonic terms was born Joseph Paget in 1837 on a farm about 50 miles northwest of Montreal, Canada. At the age of 20, he married a local woman, 3 years his senior, from a family named Roos. They had 5 children over the course of almost as many years. Around 1862, he and his family moved to St. Beatrice, a small provincial town in the hills of Quebec. By then, as the New York Times would later report, quote, he'd gained a very bad reputation. He abused his wife shamefully and associated with the vilest company. It was during his years in St. Beatrice that he committed his first known sex crime, the rape of his wife's 13-year-old sister, Julianne, a girl he'd known since birth. The rape occurred in June 1871. At around 7 a.m. that day, Julianne, who did housework for a neighboring family, went to milk the cows, her usual morning chore. She was walking through an isolated corner of the pasture when she was stopped in her tracks by a sinister sight. About 50 feet away from her stood a man, dressed in a red flannel shirt and baggy linen trousers, held up by a black leather belt. She didn't recognize him because, under the black hat, he wore a macabre mask that had been fashioned from buffalo hide. In his hand, he carried a wooden cudgel, about 2.5 feet long, and as thick as Julian's arm. The man stood there watching her for a moment, and then suddenly, with no warning, the man bolted toward her, moving so quickly, his hat flew off his head. Julianne screamed, and she turned and ran, but she wasn't fast enough. When the man caught her and spun her around, she reached up and tore away his grotesque mask. The face of her brother-in-law, Joseph, was revealed. His features twisted, she later testified, with savage lust. Joseph gripped Julianne around the throat and threw her to the ground. He straddled her, and as she cried out, he reached for a handful of sandy soil and shoved it into her mouth to try and silence her. She looked at him in panic, and he grabbed another handful of dirt and ground it into her eyes. He then lifted her skirt and tore away her underclothes. She lost consciousness while he was raping her. When she awoke, she found herself alone in the pasture. She staggered back to her employer's house and told him what had happened. Alarmed and angry, he immediately contacted the police. An arrest warrant was issued for Joseph, but he managed to escape the authorities. Julianne, unable at first to keep down any food or drink, took more than a month to recover from her physical injuries. By then, her attacker had fled Canada with his wife and children. Joseph had vanished, at least for a while. Three years later, on the afternoon of Friday, July 27, 1874, a young schoolteacher, Miss Marietta Ball of St. Albans, Vermont, closed her one-room schoolhouse for the day and started off down a lonely stretch of road to visit a friend on the south side of the small community. She never arrived. The following day, search parties scoured the woods for any sign of her, and a group of men came upon a horrible sight. They found Marietta's naked corpse, quote, hideously violated and mangled in a most fiendish manner. She was lying in a little gully beneath a pile of leaves. At the inquest, the coroner, Dr. H.H. Farnsworth, determined that her skull had been crushed with a rock. She had been raped. But whether it was before or after her death was impossible to say. Determined to discover who had killed this well-liked young woman, her neighbors put together all the money they could and hired a detective from Boston to investigate the matter. The detective began interviewing everyone who knew Marietta, including her students, and soon learned about a suspicious character who had been asking the schoolchildren about Miss Ball's route home in the weeks prior to her disappearance. This same man allegedly had bruises and scratches on his face immediately after her murder. Known for his generally crude demeanor, especially toward women, the suspect had been living in the French neighborhood of St. Albans since his arrival from Quebec 3 years earlier. The man's name was Joseph Lepage. Lepage was promptly arrested, but he managed to produce witnesses who were willing to testify that he was working in a hayfield at the time of the murder and supported his claims that his face had been scratched by thorns while he was berry picking. With no hard evidence against him, he was released. The following March, he and his family suddenly packed up and left town. A short time later, they showed up in Pembroke, New Hampshire, where Lepage found work as a woodcutter for a man named Joe Daniels, who supplied wood to power the steam engines in the Pembroke Mills. In late September 1875, just 6 months after the Lepage family moved to Pembroke, several people reported a strange figure lurking along the country road that led to the local school. 17-year-old Clarence Cochran was one of them. He was headed to class on the last Friday of the month when, he later testified, he, quote, saw a man jump into the bushes on the left side of the road, about 50 feet ahead of him. Believing that it was his friend John Colby, a practical joker who liked to hide in the bushes and spring out as his unsuspecting friends, Cochran shouted at him, "Get out of there, you long-legged son of a gun! You can't scare me!" But when Clarence reached the spot where the figure had vanished into the underbrush, no one was there. The following day, Mrs. Alberzia Watson and her youngest daughter Annie, a student at Pembroke Academy, were walking along the same lonely stretch of road. Suddenly sensing that someone was behind them, they turned and saw, quote, a man standing by the side of the road about 100 feet away, holding a stick in his right hand. Mrs. Watson couldn't make out his features, but she could see he was of stocky build and had what she described as black hair and whiskers, tan-colored overalls, and a black slouch hat. As the mother and daughter hurried on their way, the man quickly followed them. Throwing a protective arm around her daughter, who was now whimpering in fear, Mrs. Watson hurried the girl along. By now, the man was, quote, partly running. He was almost upon them when, rounding a bend, Mrs. Watson spotted a neighbor, George Mack, picking berries in a nearby field. As Mrs. Watson steered her daughter toward Mack, she threw a quick glance over her shoulder and saw the man who was pursuing them duck into the woods and disappear. That same weekend, Hiram Towle and his wife Harriet were driving their buggy along Academy Road when they saw, quote, a man coming, carrying a stick behind him in a peculiar way. As they drew up beside him, he glanced at Mrs. Towle with a look that made her shake with fear. She later testified, quote, I thought he might be crazy. I felt afraid of the man. By the time that Mr. and Mrs. Towle passed him on the road, Lepage had already set his sights on another victim. It was not a teacher this time, but one of the students attending Pembroke Academy. Exactly which student he planned to kill was unclear. It appeared that his original plan had been to kill Letitia Fowler, the 16-year-old daughter of a farmer named Trueworthy Fowler, or her schoolmate, Sarah Prentice. On September 22nd, while working as a field hand for Fowler, Lepage saw Letitia as she crossed the front yard and entered the house. He immediately began asking her 20-year-old brother Andrew about the girl. Who was she? Where did she go to school? What road did she take to get there? Oblivious to how inappropriate and sinister these questions were, Andrew obligingly answered him and even pointed out the school when he and Lepage drove a wagon past it a few days later. Sarah Prentice also caught Lepage's eye while he was working for Fowler. When he saw her walking past the farm, he pulled aside a 13-year-old boy named Edwin Mayer and questioned him about the girl, asking her name, where she lived, and if any of the local boys were courting her. When he made a crude remark about, quote, certain parts of the girl's anatomy, young Edwin was so startled that he turned and fled. Evidence suggests that LaPage intended to attack either Letitia or Sarah on the morning of October 4th, 1875, as they made their way to school. For some reason, though, his plan was never carried out. Both Sarah and Letitia made it safely to school, but their classmate, Josie Langmaid, was not so lucky. Just 2 months shy of her 18th birthday, Josie was a pretty and popular girl who usually made the 2.5-mile walk to school with her 16-year-old brother, Waldo. On that morning, though, Josie had promised to wait for a friend. Waldo, growing impatient, waited with his sister for as long as he could, but then headed off to school by himself. When the first bell rang at the academy, summoning students to class, Josie gave up on her wait and started off to school on her own. At around 9 a.m., 5 minutes after the final bell had already sounded, a farmer named Bernard Giles passed her as she was hurrying in the direction of the school. He was the last person, except for her killer, to see her alive. When Waldo returned home from school that afternoon and told his parents that his sister had never shown up, an anxious Mrs. Langmaid hurried around to neighboring houses to see if Josie might be with one of her friends. Except for Bernard Giles, however, no one had seen her all day. Within an hour, news of her disappearance had spread throughout the community. Dozens of men began searching the countryside, and as darkness fell, the search continued by lantern light. At around 8 p.m., a farmer named Daniel Merrill became the unlucky man who stumbled on Josie's savaged corpse in a marshy patch of woods about 80 feet from the road. Merrill later testified that the body was, quote, lying on its back with the right arm doubled under and the left crossed over the breast. The right foot was drawn up. The clothing appeared to have been removed and thrown back, all saturated with blood. The breast was bare. Josie's vulva had been cut away and carried off by the killer. It was never found. Her head had been cleanly severed, and it wasn't found at the scene. The following morning, another searcher, Horace Eyre, discovered Josie's head, rolled in her blue cloak, and dumped in the woods about a quarter mile from where the body had been found. During the post-mortem examination, it was revealed that before he cut her head off with the axe, a killer had crushed her skull with a club and then stomped on her face for good measure, leaving a clear print of his boot heel on one cheek. The young woman had been so badly beaten that every bone in her left hand had been shattered as she tried to shield her head from the blows. The first suspect in the murder was a 24-year-old stonemason named William Drew, who, though married with children, was reported to have made improper advances toward a number of schoolgirls, including Josie. It turned out, though, that witnesses supported Drew's claim that he'd been mending a wall on a neighbor's farm at the time of the murder. A few days later, officials in Pembroke received a letter from the coroner in St. Albans, Vermont, who'd read about the Langmaid case in the newspaper. He noted the striking similarity to the rape and murder of Marietta Ball that occurred a year and a half earlier, and noted that the main suspect in their case was now living in Pembroke. His name was Joseph Paget, but the description in the letter matched Joseph LaPage to a T. The police immediately paid a visit to the home of the accused killer, and a search of LaPage's bedroom turned up a blood-soaked overcoat, a bloody hat, and a pair of trousers that were, quote, bespattered with blood from the belt line all the way down to the cuffs. A comparison of his boots to the heel print that had been left on Josie's face revealed a perfect match. LaPage insisted he'd been roaming around in the woods at the time of the murder, but a high school girl named Hattie Galt swore she'd seen him walking on Academy Road with an axe in his hands at 8:30 that morning. Another witness, Thomas Gardner, told the police that on the afternoon of October 4th, after Josie was reported missing but her body had not yet been found, he and his wife had received a visit from LaPage. When Mrs. Gardner remarked on Josie's disappearance, LaPage allegedly blurted out, "It's too bad that girl's been killed." Then, seemingly aware he'd revealed information he wasn't supposed to know, he turned and hurried away as quickly as he could. LaPage was taken into custody and indicted for murder, rape, and the mutilation of Josie Langmaid. During his incarceration, a newspaper reporter sought out LaPage's wife and questioned her about the murder of Marietta Ball. She claimed she had no evidence that would link him to the crime, but she added that since that time, she had, quote, foiled an attempt by him to ravish their own 15-year-old daughter, and she had to admit that he was capable of committing it. Meanwhile, LaPage was trying hard to dig his way to freedom with a makeshift tool he'd fashioned from a piece of his metal bed frame. He managed to pry 17 bricks from the wall of his cell before his jailers became aware of his efforts. A huge crowd showed up at the Concord City Hall for the start of LaPage's trial on Tuesday, January 4, 1876. Before the actual proceedings began, the jurors, along with the defendant, were taken to the scene of the murder. As LaPage looked on with little interest, the dozen jurors were taken into the woods and shown exactly where the headless body of the young woman had been found. A large stake marking the spot had been driven into the earth, and the surrounding trees and bushes had been draped with pieces of black cloth, tokens of mourning from Josie's friends and neighbors. The makeshift memorial was eventually turned into a permanent monument, a 15-foot stone obelisk that was erected by local townsfolk. The stone still stands near the spot where Josie's headless corpse was found. Inscribed on the stone are these words. Erected by the citizens of Pembroke and vicinity to commemorate the place of the tragic death and memory of Josie A. Langmaid, a student of Pembroke Academy who was murdered on her way to school on the fourth day of October 1875, aged 17 years, 10 months, and 27 days. Also included on the stone are helpful directions to the precise spot in the woods where her decapitated head was found. From the somber place where Josie's body was found, the jurors were taken to the place where the head was discovered. On a nearby tree, someone had whittled away a section of the bark, and on the exposed wood had inscribed the following with a lead pencil. J. Langmaid's head found here, October 5th, 1875. Poor Josie. May her soul rest in peace. The trial lasted for 6 days and was highlighted by the appearance of Julian Rouse, LaPage's French-speaking sister-in-law, who testified through a translator about the terrifying morning 5 years earlier when LaPage had attacked and raped her. In the end, the jury took only 90 minutes to convict him. Unfortunately for the prosecution, the appeals court ruled that Judge Foster had erred in admitting Julian's testimony, since it had no direct bearing on the Langmaid murder. The reversal, though, was only a temporary setback for the state. A second trial in March 1877 ended with another swift conviction. A year passed before LaPage's execution on March 15, 1878. According to the New York Times, LaPage was a perfectly docile prisoner while confined at the state prison in Concord, New Hampshire. He gave no trouble to the warden, never complained about his treatment, or asked for anything. On the Monday before his scheduled hanging, he had a final meeting with his family, but apart from a few tears shed by one of his daughters, there was, quote, little emotion manifested by any of them. At parting, he kissed his wife and daughters, but only shook hands with his two boys. On the afternoon before the execution, LaPage received a visit from two priests. They prayed together in his cell until nearly midnight. Almost as soon as they left, LaPage, who had maintained that he was innocent throughout his trial and incarceration, summoned the warden to his cell. Falling to his knees and speaking in broken English, he tearfully confessed to the murders of the two young women. He stated that he felt greatly relieved after his confession. When the priests returned early the next morning, they found LaPage eating a hearty breakfast. After receiving the sacrament, he was led to the gallows, which had been erected in the corridor of the prison's north wing. A large crowd had assembled, including Josie Langmaid's father, James, who was not only still devastated by the murder of his daughter, but also by the death of his 13-year-old son, Waldo, who had died from tuberculosis only 2 months after Josie had been killed. At around 11 a.m., LaPage was led to the scaffold by Sheriff Dodge, who read aloud the death warrant and adjusted the noose around the prisoner's neck. He drew the black hood over LaPage's head, tied his arms and legs, and then sprang the trap door. LaPage plunged downward, bouncing once with a snap of his neck. The New York Times reported, quote, "A slight twitching of the legs was the only motion observable after he fell." Officiating physicians, Drs. A.H. Crosby, C.P. Gage, and J.W. Barney, monitored his fading heartbeat and pronounced him dead after nearly 20 minutes. His corpse was taken to a local undertaker, and he was buried without ceremony at Blossom Hill Cemetery. But he did not rest there in peace. But it's not what you think. 2 weeks later, a, quote, "party of young scamps stole into the graveyard at midnight, exhumed the corpse, and left it hanging from a water pipe in the yard of the State House. It greeted the citizens of Concord the next morning, April 1st, April Fool's Day. Before I wrap up this episode, I did want to mention that if you've ever wondered what I'm working on when I post photos from film shoots, you can see one of them on Monday, February 9th on History's Greatest Mysteries, which is available on the History Channel and on streaming. This one is about werewolves, so I hope you'll check it out. For this show, though, I want to say thanks again for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like this show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows on the network and recommend them to your friends, family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. If you do have thoughts or comments about American Nightmares, leave us a review or text your comments to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. As a thank you, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast, and that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really a small business that's grateful for all your support, because we couldn't and we wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. As long as the devil doesn't get you first.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network. This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.